Chemical Watch podcast.
Unlock the full value of your compliance and product stewardship with world-leading insight and intelligence from Chemical Watch. To find out more or request a demo, visit chemicalwatch.com. Chemical Watch, intelligence to transform product safety.
Hello and welcome to this week's news podcast, hosted by members of the Chemical Watch team. I'm Kate Lowe, Global Managing Editor at Chemical Watch, and for today's episode, I'm joined by our business editor, Lee Stringer, Europe reporter Catherine Carlson, and North America Managing Editor Terry Hyland. The subjects we'll be discussing today include the US state of Oregon's Toxic Free Kids program, under which substances of concern in many children's products are to be phased out. We'll also be taking a look at the latest thinking from the European Commission on the potential use of essential use criteria from the Montreal Protocol, which regulates substances that deplete the ozone layer, for the control of hazardous chemicals under REACH. But first, let's start with the Belgian-based company Solvay, which has denied NGO claims that it is hindering research into a new per- and polyfluoroalkyl substance, or PFAS, by issuing a patent violation notification to a laboratory for selling its analytical reference standard on the chemical. Certified reference standards are synthesized pure forms of a chemical compound. They are often developed by laboratories and sold to researchers in small amounts who can use them to analyze their presence in the environment. In July last year, Solvay notified Canada-based Wellington Laboratories that selling its certified reference standard infringed Solvay's patent rights for the PFAS known as C604. Solvay issued the violation notification because it was concerned the sale of Wellington's standard, which is a synthesized form of C604, could enable competitors to duplicate or develop a competitive product. So Lee, first of all, can you tell us what exactly NGOs have said about this development?
Yes, thanks, Kate. An interesting development here. So NGOs have criticised the move, saying the patent violation notification impedes important environmental research into the compound. Their main argument is that companies producing industrial chemicals should not have control over research efforts into their chemicals that potentially are in the environment, and they're saying that this move is obstructing that sort of work. For example, we spoke to Professor David Andrews, a senior scientist at the Environmental Working Group, and he said time and time again PFAS manufacturers have profited from keeping their scientific data hidden, and he added that the current system of regulating industrial chemicals in the US is broken because it relies heavily on the good faith of chemical companies, he said. But he also said that hopefully this leads to a long-term change because there is a solution. He suggests that all industrial chemical manufacturers should provide the EPA with chemical standards to enable pollution monitoring and toxicity testing. And much of what he said was echoed by others. For example, Tom Bruton, senior scientist at the Green Science Policy Institute, told us that through its action, Solvay is in effect setting the rules for which chemicals environmental researchers can and can't measure. And like Professor Andrews, he added that it is common sense that the company releasing these chemicals should not have the power to do this. He said that manufacturers of persistent industrial chemicals should be helping to advance efforts to monitor their products in the environment so that problems can be caught early on. And his conclusion, he sort of pointed out that pesticide manufacturers are required to submit analytical standards of their products to the US EPA prior to approval. And so question, why isn't the same true for PFASs?
Okay, thanks, Lee. Before we turn to Solvay's response, can you just tell us what Wellington Laboratories' take is on what has happened?
Yeah, sure. So the lab said it purchased C604 from a company associated with Solvay, and then it proceeded to fractionate, purify, characterize, and create a solution, i.e. a standard, after receiving requests from the Italian Environment Agency for such a certified reference standard. Now, this standard was generated to investigate potential contamination in Italy. Solvay permitted the sale of the standard to the agency. However, the company said it then attempted to negotiate a license agreement with the lab, but it said that Wellington preferred to discontinue the standard. Now, when we spoke to Wellington Labs, it claimed that the negotiations collapsed because Solvay wanted to screen requests and authorize who was able to purchase its standard. The lab said that patents are usually associated with a specific process, and in the case of C604, the patent specifies a method of making fluoropolymer dispersions. Now, Wellington Labs said that at the extremely low concentration of their reference standards, which are sold in 1.2 milliliter volumes, it's practically impossible, it says, that it could be used for such a purpose. So after it received Solvay's letter stating that its product infringed on the company's patent rights, the lab contacted Solvay immediately because it assumed there was a misunderstanding as to the nature of its product. They also added that in the 35 years of operating, Wellington Labs has never had an industrial manufacturer claim patent infringement on any of its products.
Okay, thanks, Lee. So let's hear Solvay's side of the story. How has the company responded to what the NGOs and Wellington have said?
Yeah, sure. So it's come straight back on the comments made by the NGOs and the lab. It confirmed that C604 is a Solvay patented PFAS for internal use only, it said, and it's not offered for sale. And it's also manufactured outside the US. In response to the NGO criticism, Solvay said it makes considerable effort to engage in good faith with authorities and stakeholders, including cooperating on reliable investigations of its processing aids. The company said it issued the violation notification purely because it was concerned the sale of Wellington standard could enable competitors to duplicate or develop a competitive product. And it said it sought to work collaboratively with Wellington laboratories to have available certified standards for research and study of its substance on the condition that Solvay be protected from competitive harm given its patent position. It's also said that it's going to, it's working with a third party to develop its own standard, but it didn't say exactly who and when it'll be providing this. What will be interesting is if this situation draws further attention to how analytical reference standards are developed, how labs obtain reference standard licenses, and I think more importantly, whether it will drive authorities to consider the arguments raised by the NGOs and potentially introduce mandatory obligations for chemical producers to provide reference standards to regulators.
Okay, thanks very much, Lee. So now let's turn to Oregon, which has set in motion implementation of the final phase of its children's products program, which will focus on phasing out chemicals of concern. The state's toxic-free kids program already requires manufacturers of covered products to notify the presence of any of 68 substances included on the state's high priority chemicals of concern for children's health list above de minimis levels. But unlike similar laws in other states, Oregon's Toxic Free Kids Act contains a provision requiring manufacturers to remove chemicals of concern from certain products or seek a waiver for their continued use, which is where Oregon's finalized rule to guide the phase out comes in. So, Terry, can you tell us more? What are the new requirements under Oregon's rule?
Yeah, thanks, Kate. So, yeah, you laid it out very well. So this final rule implements the third phase of Oregon's Toxic Free Kids Act, and that law was passed in 2015. And just very briefly, the first phase created the list of high priority chemicals of concern for children's health. And as you noted, there are currently 68 substances listed. The second phase then laid out the requirements for manufacturers of children's products to disclose categories of products that contain any of the listed high priority chemicals. And those disclosure notices are due every 2 years. The first notice or disclosure due date was on the 1st of January, 2018, and then again, 1st of January, 2020. And the third notice due date is set for the beginning of next year, January 2020. So why am I talking about these notification due dates? Well, under this rule, it's the third notification period on the 1st of January, 2022, that comes into play for this third phase. And the finalized rule for the phase, the third phase, requires manufacturers to phase out the use of these 68 high concern substances across three product categories: children's cosmetics, mouthable products, and products that are made for or marketed to children younger than 3 years old. And this phase out requirement makes Oregon's program one of the most stringent in the US. So going beyond the notification disclosure programs that are already in place in states like Washington or Vermont. And there are some familiar chemical names on the list of 68 substances: formaldehyde, benzene, methylene chloride, BPA and BPS, and perfluorooctane sulfonic acid, or PFOS, and its salts, and several types of phthalates as well. But under this new rule, unless they get a waiver or an exemption, manufacturers of these types of children's products must remove or find a substitute for these 68 high concern substances by that third notice period. And as we mentioned, that the due date for that is the 1st of January, 2022.
Okay, thank you, Terry. So what exactly is the process for companies seeking a waiver or exemption from Oregon's phase out requirements?
Yeah, and it's important to note too, those are two separate things under the rule. So companies can seek a waiver, and there are a small number of companies that can try to get an exemption. And the exemptions are fairly narrow. There's a small business exemption. If your global annual sales are less than $5 million, you can seek to be exempt from the final rule. Or if you have 25 or fewer employees, you can ask for a 2-year extension before you have to comply. And then there's one more exemption category. If a company can show that any high concern substances are present only as a contaminant, so not intentionally added, and that they have a manufacturing control process in place, kind of showing that they're doing all they can, then they can also seek an exemption that way. It's interesting to note that after the rule was proposed last June by Oregon's health authority, State Representative Courtney Neron, who was the bill's main sponsor, she submitted comments to the agency saying this final rule should have as few exemptions as possible. And it certainly seems like the health authority largely followed that advice with the final rule. Now, there's also a waiver process under the rule. To get a waiver, a company has to either conduct an exposure assessment and show that there won't be exposure to the high concern chemicals or chemical or chemicals from reasonable, foreseeable use and abuse of the product. So companies have to be able to show that the substance won't migrate into children's bodies from expected wear and tear on these products, which, well, with anybody who has or knows kids, can be pretty rigorous. Companies also can seek a waiver by conducting an alternatives analysis and showing that eliminating or using a substance is just not financially or technically feasible. And there is a process as well if a company plans to use a substitute chemical to replace one of these listed substances. So to use a substitute, companies will have to conduct a hazard assessment showing that the substitute substance is less hazardous than the listed chemical it's replacing. And the idea here is to avoid the potential for regrettable substitutions. But that may not be all. So in the midst of all these new requirements, the state legislature is considering a new bill, House Bill 2495, that could potentially expand the Toxic Free Kids Act in two main ways. First, the bill, if it is passed into law, would expand the substance disclosure requirement, and it would require manufacturers to disclose not just a product category that does have a high concern substance, but they would also have to disclose the specific brand name and model of the product. And that would put it more in line with Vermont's disclosure requirements, for example. And the second area, the bill would also give the Oregon Health Authority the ability to expand the list of high priority chemicals of concern to consider entire classes of substances rather than having to list substances individually. So if this bill is approved and signed into law, the program could potentially expand to cover whole groups of substances, like all PFAS or all types of phthalates, for example.
Okay, thanks very much, Terry. Now, a federal appeals court recently allowed a separate federal ban on 5-phthalates in children's products to continue, but it criticised the rule from the Consumer Product Safety Commission, saying it didn't allow proper opportunity to comment on the rule. So can you tell us a little more about what happened and what it means for that rule?
Yeah, so still sticking with children's products, but now we're talking about the federal ban here. So the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and that's one of the 13 U.S. courts of appeals that sit the level just below the U.S. Supreme Court, the Fifth Circuit here declined a request from 5 industry groups to throw out a rule from the CPSC that effectively bans 5-phthalates in children's toys and childcare articles. Now, the court did agree with some of the industry complaints against the rule. The court said that the CPSC's justification for the final rule had actually changed from the time it first proposed the measure to when it did actually finalize the rule. And that was because new data came to light after the rule was proposed back in 2014, and that this new data showed that potentially these 5-phthalates weren't quite as hazardous as previous studies had indicated. The commission, the CPSC, however, said there were still individuals, even under this new research, there were still individuals that faced a high exposure to these phthalates. And that then was justification, in part anyways, to proceed and finalize the rule. The court here said that change in rationale should have been opened up for public comment. But the court also said that this wasn't so catastrophic that the rule should be completely vacated. So what the ruling does here is it allows the ban to stay in effect, but the CPSC has to go back and allow public comment on their underlying justifications for the rule and then consider those comments. And separately, the court said the CPSC also has to consider the costs, not just the health benefits, of its decision to ban one of the 5-phthalates, and that's DINP. And that one phthalate stands out here because it was specifically regulated under the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act. So the bottom line is this ban on the 5-phthalates stays in place, but the CPSC still has some work to do to meet the court's requirements.
Okay, thanks very much for that, Terry. So finally, let's take a look at the latest thinking from the European Commission on the potential use of essential use criteria from the Montreal Protocol, which regulates substances that deplete the ozone layer for the control of hazardous chemicals under REACH. In a paper submitted to the competent authorities for REACH and CLP, or CARICAL, ahead of their meeting last week, the EU executive summarised and responded to some of the arguments that have been made by stakeholders around essential use in reaction to an earlier thought starter document. So, Catherine, can you begin by telling us what exactly were the concerns that stakeholders raised in response to this thought starter by the Commission?
Hi, Kelly. Oh, sorry, cough. I'm going to start again. Hi, Kate. So responses to the thought starter threw up a lot of concerns. Who can decide what essential use is? Who has the authority to? How this can be done legally? If it even can be done legally? And if so, who should be consulted on it? And as you can see in several stories we've run on this, the responses are somewhat all over the map. There's no clear consensus among stakeholders on the best way forward. And it's no different when it comes to the Montreal Protocol. The Commission's summary of the responses said that some responses considered it a good starting point to help develop essential use criteria, while others said it was not appropriate at all because the scope of the protocol is so much more narrow than the future scope of the essential use principle. I've also often heard Montreal Protocol essentiality discussed with reference to a future broad PFAS restriction. action, which we understand will also involve some sort of essential use principle. Now, many of the thought starter responses also reference this future restriction, but the Commission dismissed this in its response, saying that the action on PFAS is an entirely separate process, and comments on that restriction aren't relevant to this overall discussion of essential use.
Okay, thanks, Catherine. So how has the Commission responded to those concerns?
Well, the response document broke the Montreal Protocol criteria down into four parts: the criticality, alternatives, use, and availability of the chemical in question. It stressed that those criteria are only used as a starting point for discussions on the EU definition, but that of those four, the first, criticality, is the major one for determining essential use. The Commission also said that all relevant criteria, it's a quote, would have to be fulfilled for a use to be considered essential, but it wasn't explicit about what all relevant criteria means. For the criteria of alternatives and use, the document said that assessments of these are to some extent already covered by ECHA's Risk Assessment and Socioeconomic Assessment Committees, RAC and SEAC. For the last criterion, availability, which refers to how scarce a resource the substance is, the Commission said this wasn't really relevant for REACH, but maybe for other chemicals legislation, and that the assessment of availability would be on a case-by-case basis.
Okay, thanks very much. So what then are the next steps for the development of this concept?
Well, the Commission is planning to include the concept in an impact assessment, which will be used to prepare a future REACH revision. It's also planning on developing a working paper, which it will present at a workshop at some point in the future, although there's no time frame yet. It's also planning a study to address knowledge gaps around essential use, which will include a consultation with interest groups. And then there's the new high-level stakeholder roundtable on the overall EU chemical strategy, which is being formed at the moment. So stakeholders will likely have an opportunity to weigh in on the concept when the group meets within the next few months. The Commission also said that the application of essential use criteria will go beyond REACH and into other chemicals legislation. So discussions with competent authorities for REACH and CLP, known as CARICAL, alone won't be enough, and it's planning to involve experts from other legislative areas too.
Okay, thanks very much, Catherine. So that brings us to the end of today's episode. So thank you again to Lee, Terry and Catherine for sharing their insight into today's stories with us. And thank you too to our audience for listening to today's episode. If you would like to find out more about the topics from today's discussion, please head over to the Chemical Watch website at chemicalwatch.com. Until next week, goodbye.
Unlock the full value of your compliance and product stewardship with world-leading insight and intelligence from Chemical Watch. To find out more or request a demo, visit chemicalwatch.com. Chemical Watch, intelligence to transform product safety.
Chemical Watch Podcast.